now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
Yes, and how's it? And welcome to the new era of eloquence and exposition. This is Life from the Pulpit, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, live and local on location at Merced Church of Christ, deep in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society. With a little help from my friends, I am your host for this half-hour excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the Valley, Nick Perez. Greetings, and welcome to the program. So the next several weeks, I want to look at and examine the book of Daniel with a view toward taking time with the book of Revelation. Seems like a lot of people are focused on the book of Revelation these days, and I figured I might as well put forward the right way of looking at the book of Revelation. Just so many awkward, strange, just flat-out wrong ideas of what the book of Revelation is saying. Well, you need the backbone of Old Testament prophecy if you're going to flesh out what the book of Revelation says. And so that's why I want to spend as long as it takes to get through the book of Daniel. I don't see this taking more than... It'll probably be this month, this entire month, month of July. Well, we're going to talk about Daniel. Let me just say by way of introduction, if we take this book for what it is, this book is extremely valuable to our faith. It's a powerful book of evidence. Again, if we take it for what it is, for what it's saying, this is a marvelous book to bolster our faith. Daniel is important for a number of reasons. When it comes to history, and when it comes to God's involvement in history, you see it all over the pages of Daniel. For years, Daniel was the only historical source of information about a couple of things. One was Belshazzar. Belshazzar is a character we're introduced to in chapter 5 of Daniel. But for a long time, Daniel was the only document of antiquity which mentioned this man. And for a while, this was something that biblical criticizers, critics of the faith, they would say, the Bible's wrong. We don't know this guy Belshazzar. Especially in the 1700s, when you had a lot of liberal stuff popping up, liberal biblical criticism. The Bible's wrong. There's no record of this Belshazzar character. Further, he's not a son of Nebuchadnezzar, as is mentioned in the text of Daniel. Well, what happened? How come people don't say that anymore? Well, as the spade of the archaeologist digs, they turned over the dirt, and what did they find? A guy by the name of Belshazzar. Belshazzar, he appears in a tablet that they discover that they dug up, and suddenly, the Bible's not the only document to mention this guy Belshazzar. In fact, archaeology, again and again, this is the case, archaeology proves the Bible is accurate when it speaks about some historical figure or some historical place or some historical account. The Bible is telling the truth about that particular historical person, place, or thing. And so there's stuff like that. Belshazzar, he's just sort of the prime example. Some history is only hinted at in secular history. Like Nebuchadnezzar, he has this crazy spell that happens to him in chapter 4 of Daniel. It's hinted at, there's glimpses and glimmers of it in pagan sources, but the Bible, the book of Daniel, offers up in gleaming light what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, when we think of Daniel, typically we think of prophecies, although only about half of the book is prophecy, the other half is just Daniel's life. But the prophecies in there, you know, prophecies sometimes, they're easy to understand, right? They're very straightforward as to what's going to happen. And there's not a lot of figures. Well, there's some prophecy, like Daniel's prophecy, which is can be extremely difficult to understand. Nevertheless, there they are. What do we do with them? Well, we got to do our best to interpret these things. Let me ask you this. In terms of prophecy, was God silent between the Testaments? In that intertestamental period, we talk about the 400 years of silence. Was God really silent? Is that true? Well, in one way, it's true. No one was speaking the words of God. But in another case, it's false, at least in one way. It's false in that Daniel had already spoken about what was going to happen. He already laid down a roadmap about, in detail, what was going to happen between the testaments. So in one sense, no, God is not silent during the intertestamental period between the Old and New Testaments, that time there. These prophecies are very detailed. And they range from the end of the exile, when Israel, Daniel is writing and speaking these prophecies while he's in exile. But his prophecies, they go from the end of the exile all the way through to the 11th emperor of Rome. That guy's name, by the way, is Domitian. He makes an appearance in Daniel. I'll point that out as we go through. But very detailed, from the end of the exile all the way through to the end of the Roman Empire, essentially. Not all the way down to today. I'm going to point that out as we go through as well, especially Daniel chapter 2 and the image of the, or the vision of the image, the golden image. People make a lot, they develop entire theologies about the 10 toes, but you can't find the 10 toes in the biblical text. Again, I'll deal with that in due time. Daniel, he prophesies the rise and fall of several future kingdoms. You remember, he interprets the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, his vision, gives the interpretation. He talks about these are coming kingdoms, Nebuchadnezzar. You, Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, and then the chest and arms of silver, and the thighs of bronze, etc. Those are future kingdoms. Daniel foresees the coming of the church in Daniel chapter 2 as well. That's part of the strength, the importance of these prophecies. The focus, though, will be on the kingdom of Greece under Alexander the Great. And this kingdom will rise to its peak under Alexander when he dies, and then it'll be divided. The horn is broken. That's the language that Daniel uses in his text. And four horns come forth from this one broken horn. Well, that's the division of the Grecian kingdom. Again, we'll deal with that when we come to it in the text. Daniel, his prophecies deal with the coming of Messiah, the death of Messiah. Deals with the coming prince who brings destruction. That's Titus. Talks about the abomination that causes desolation, which Jesus talks about in Matthew chapter 24. And so we have to look, we have to see the prophecy. They find their fulfillment, and we can point to historically when they do find their fulfillment. Some are very difficult. Some of these prophecies are very difficult, but one thing will help us. You see, the Bible will help us to interpret the Bible. The Bible will interpret itself. Let the Bible interpret itself. That's a good biblical hermeneutic principle. If the Bible says that this is that, then we know that, well, this is that. When Daniel says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the golden head, we know that Daniel's not talking about someone else being the golden head. Right? There you go. So, like again, even in chapters of this book, that'll help. Sometimes the New Testament will help. Like Mark chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, or 9, verse 1, the kingdom of God and all that stuff. Or we can look at secular history, and we can find how these prophecies find fulfillment, what these prophecies mean based on the light that is shed on them by secular history. That helps especially with Daniel chapter 11, and these princes from the north and from the south, and you know, guys in this stuff. Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. We'll talk about him when we get there. But stuff like that helps shed light when we look at secular history. There are all kinds of kingdom concepts. Daniel's important for the concepts of the kingdom that he presents. The kingdom makes an entrance, an appearance. It talks about its duration. What's going to happen to Messiah? How will the kingdom manifest itself with Messiah? All those questions, they are answered in Daniel's text. Like I said, Daniel, the book of Daniel is a powerful, powerful, extremely valuable for evidential tool. Again, if we take it for what it is, it's powerful evidence. We're interested in building our faith, right? You want to build your faith up? Well, one way you do that is historical Christian evidence helps, but the book of Daniel helps with this as well. If you believe that Daniel lived in the 6th century BC, that the Lord revealed all this to him, that he wrote it hundreds of years before any of it took place, then that only confirms beyond a shadow of a doubt that God exists. That he revealed himself to Daniel. He revealed his plans. Daniel is one of the great anchors of the Bible. One of the greatest anchors of the faith in the Bible. In times of doubt, what should you do? Think of Daniel. Think Daniel. How did he know that this stuff was going to happen before it ever happened? Even critics who removed Daniel from the 6th century BC to the 2nd century BC, there are still many prophecies that were yet to happen in the future. How did he know these things? But again, Daniel, he did write in the 6th century BC. And again, how did he know any of this stuff? You either know or you don't know. I'll just give you an illustration. I don't want to endorse or condone the lottery, but how about no? What if you knew the numbers of the lottery? You said on such and such date the numbers for the lottery were going to be, and you gave the, what is it, 5 or 6 numbers? I don't even know. How do you know that? You either know them or you don't. Even if we were to bump this thing up to the night before the balls are selected for the lottery, even if you're the night before, you say, no, the numbers are going to be this. How did you know? Yeah, that's a weak illustration to talk about Daniel. How did he know this stuff? Unless the God of heaven, and there is a God of heaven, unless he revealed these things to Daniel beforehand. And he did. He did. Let's talk a little bit about Daniel. We're doing introductory material, right? What about Daniel? His name means the Lord is my judge. Guys, church historians in the 4th century, Porphyry and Jerome, they both concluded that a 2nd century writer could not have known some of the stuff that was happening. Excuse me. Both men concluded a 2nd century writer for a 6th century author could not know the future. They tried to remove the inspiration. That's what I'm getting at here. Those were some of the early critics, if you will, of the biblical text. They were the first two to suggest this line of thinking that, you know, to know what was going to happen in the 2nd century, you couldn't have a 6th century writer, 6th century author talking about what was going to happen in the 2nd century. In the 17th and 18th century, that stuff really kicked up. The Age of Enlightenment, that began a new wave of criticism until archaeology put a number of those things to rest, shut a lot of those guys up. But there are still people running around today who believe that the writing came later. They try to take away the miraculous, try to take away the inspiration factor. There's no way a man can know the future. No way, unless God revealed it to him, and that's a biblical principle. God is the one who gives the interpretation for visions and things like that. Well, who wrote the book? Was it really this guy Daniel from the 6th century BC, or was it, you know, some scribe in the 2nd century BC writing about this guy named Daniel who lived in the 6th century BC? And there are, I'll just give you somewhat of a shorthand. Daniel wrote it, 6th century BC. But let's look at the testimony, if you will, in favor of Daniel for being the author. When you read it, for one, you read a man named Daniel. He was there during the reign of Darius, and then Nebuchadnezzar, and then Belshazzar, and on through the rest of them. So the book claims that Daniel's the author. Ezekiel bears testimony. Ezekiel claims Daniel was in their midst. Ezekiel 14:14, Ezekiel 28:3, Ezekiel 14:20. Daniel was in their midst. Historical corroboration. For example, the name Belshazzar. That was unknown until just recently when a tablet was found with his name on it. Put him exactly where Daniel said he would be, doing exactly what Daniel said he was doing. A guy by the name of Pritchard, he's written a book, and in his syllabus he has pictures and a translation of the tablets by official Babylonian records. And guess what? They happen to match up with Daniel chapter 5. Historical corroboration, big deal. How about the testimony of 1 Maccabees 2, verse 60. Do you have a copy of that? You can get it online. 1 Maccabees, it's a extra biblical work, not part of the canon, contrary to what our Catholic friends believe. They actually have it in their Bible. If you've got a Catholic Bible, you've got the book of 1 Maccabees in there. 1 Maccabees written about 150 BC, and it says, Daniel, for his innocence, was delivered from the mouth of lions. Just as the book of Daniel says. So there's some external evidence there for you. Dead Sea Scrolls, which were, they date to about 200 BC. Every book from the Old Testament is represented in the Dead Sea Scrolls, except for Esther. Wouldn't you know it, Daniel's part of those Dead Sea Scrolls. And the date of the scrolls, it's dated according to the time of their writing, or the time that they were used until, when they were worn out, when they were very worn out. That's how they were found. How about the testimony of Jesus? Look it up, Matthew 24 and verse 15. Testimony of Jesus, that's a big one, isn't it? Son of God. He gives some testimony about this. Matthew 24, verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, abomination of desolation, again, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, Jesus talks about Daniel. He believed that the book of Daniel was written by Daniel. How about Josephus? I mean, we could stop there with Jesus. Jesus is the final authority, right? But we can go on. Let's really build the overwhelming case here. Josephus, Daniel, is authentic history. He writes that in his Antiquities, Book 10, Chapter 10, verses 1 through 6, also Chapter 11, verses 2 through 7. Alexander the Great, he acknowledges Daniel in Josephus' Antiquities, Book 11, Chapter 8, verse 5. He tells the story in his writings where the book of Daniel is open. He's the little horn spoken about. That's how Alexander understood his role. The Jewish canon of 22 books included Daniel, Contra Appian. This is, again, Josephus, chapter 1, verses 6 through 8. It's all over, all over. Early Christian commentators never disputed the authorship of Daniel as being Daniel himself. That's what they believed. From the first century onward until the age of the Enlightenment, Daniel is a 6th century writer who wrote these prophecies. Well, there are some who have tried to postulate that Daniel wasn't. So they made arguments against a Daniel authorship. But mostly they bank on the historical inaccuracies, like the story of Belshazzar. But again, that's been laid to rest, archaeology. They point to the dates given by Jeremiah in chapter 25, verse 1, and they say, well, those are against Daniel chapter 1 and verse 1. But there are two ways of looking at when a king came to power and the two major calendars in effect, and both how they're both used. Let me put it that way. What are you talking about? How the Babylonians counted when a king came to power versus how the Jews counted when they came to power. Babylonians, they had the ascension calendar. The year that he came to power wasn't the first year. That was year zero. But his first year was the following year. For example, here we are, 2013, and let's say that the king came to power in 2013. Well, his first year, this is year zero that we're in. Let me give you an illustration from America. We elected President Barack Obama to a second term back in November 2012. He started that here in 2013 in January. We're in year zero if we're using Babylonian counting, and the first year begins next January. You confused? That's how they counted back then. It wasn't confusing to them. So those dates about Jeremiah and Daniel, well, they don't match up. Well, it's just a matter of how you count. There's the argument that Daniel, he should be included in the writings rather than in the prophets. The Hebrew Bible is divided into three sections. You've got law, prophets, and the writings. Law, that's your Pentateuch, first five books. Prophets, former and latter prophets. And then you have the other writings, which are things like Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Nehemiah. Some include Daniel in that. And they said, Daniel, he's in the other writings, and therefore he needs a later date. But there's no proof. This is their argument. You won't find that argument from Jewish records. They calculated the book with the other Jewish record as they calculated the books were included in the other writings rather than the prophets. Daniel, he was a statesman serving in the court of the king, and that's more than a prophet. Not a prophet maybe like Elijah and Elisha, but his role was as a statesman. And that's why these guys want to make that argument. Daniel, he used two languages in his writing. Two languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. Nobody else wrote like that back in Daniel's day. Well, actually, people obviously knew more than two languages even back in that day. And as the spade of the archaeologist digs, the truth and validity of the Bible is only confirmed all the more. Guys have dug up manuscripts where this ABA writing style shows up. Daniel is written ABA style. That is, he starts off in Hebrew, and then about chapter 2, verse 3 or 4, he switches over to Aramaic, and that continues all the way into chapter 7, and then he switches back to Hebrew for the rest of the book. Archaeologists have dug up manuscripts where people wrote like that. And these documents date back to the 6th century. All the more an argument, which actually verifies the 6th century BC for being the writing, because that was a common literary style in the time of Daniel. Ooh, it's pretty good. Of course, Daniel, he was taught by the Babylonian officials to know the language of the Babylonians, which was Aramaic. Daniel 1, verse 4, 2, verse 4. 2 Kings 18, verse 26, Ezra 4, verse 7, you can look those up as well, which speak of that. Daniel, he was bilingual. He spoke Hebrew, and he was taught Aramaic when he was taken captive as a young man. The two different languages, why are those used? Well, different audiences. Babylonians were speaking to the king in Aramaic. The Babylonians, that was their diplomatic language. And this is where the text switches from Hebrew to Aramaic, and that's why it switches, I should say. In chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through to chapter 7, verse 28. Then it switches back to Hebrew. It was a common literary style. Again, archaeologists have dug that style up, that ABA style, and other documents. Very intelligent writer is indicated by the writing style, a singular author, because there's a concentric style of writing. Chapter 2 information matches that in chapter 7. Chapters 3 matches chapter 6. Information chapter 3 matches chapter 6. Information chapter 4 matches chapter 5. Very, again, a concentric writing style, which all the more indicates a singular author who's very highly intelligent. What about the date? 6th century. 539 to 536, but the book covers material from 606 to 536. All of Daniel's life is spent in captivity. Virtually all of Daniel's life is spent in captivity. Daniel 1, verse 21, that's a date. Daniel was there until the first year of King Darius. That's 539 B.C. Some of these dates do vary depending upon who you talk to. But Daniel chapter 10, verse 31, talks about the third year of King Cyrus, the king of Persia. Revelation is given to Daniel, who's also called Belteshazzar in the book. 536 B.C. is when that happens. Several references that help us to understand when the material was given to Daniel. The book is not necessarily in chronological order. Chapters 1 through 6, that's Daniel and his life. And then chapters 7 through 12 kind of come back and give flavor to different points in Daniel's life. I got a chronological order here. Chapters 1 through 4 of Daniel, that's years 605 to 562. Chapter 7 is 553 B.C. All these dates are B.C. Chapter 8 is 550 B.C. Chapters 5, 9, and 6, guys have pinpointed that to 539 to 536 B.C. And then chapters 10 through 12, that's 536 B.C. Again, that's somewhat of a chronological order of Daniel. Well, I'll talk about the purposes in another episode. I need to get to the question of the day.
Question of the day.
Where in the Bible does it say that when you get married, you stay together for the rest of your life? Now that is a good question. Where in the Bible does it say when you get married, you got to stay together for the rest of your life? Well, God institutes marriage back in Genesis chapter 2. A man shall leave his father and his mother, cling to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. And in fact, Jesus, that's what he gives the authoritative voice to this in Matthew chapter 19, where he says that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female. He quotes here in verse 5 of Matthew chapter 19, a man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, two shall become one flesh. So no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. I want to make a very clear point here about what Jesus says there. He does not say, what therefore God has joined together, man cannot separate. But rather, this is a permissive imperative. Let not man separate. The possibility of ending a marriage, of splitting the marriage through divorce, is a distinct possibility. But the permissive imperative is don't break what God has fixed in heaven. That's the exhortation there. The two become one flesh, and that should be for life. Why? Well, because there's this thing which Paul talks about in Romans chapter 7 and verse 3, the law of marriage, or the law of the law concerning the husband is literally what he says there, but it's a law concerning marriage. Romans chapter 7, Paul's greater argument in Romans 7 is about the law and how Christ, we're not under law but under grace. That's what he says in the book of Romans. But he illustrates this point about being free from the law. That means to be under grace. And he argues from the marriage relationship. Do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives. When you die, you're not under the law anymore. That's what he's saying there. Verse 2, for a married woman is bound by the law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. That's the law of marriage there is about they're supposed to be married throughout their entire life. But when one spouse dies, that's the end of the marriage. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law. And if she marries another man, she's not an adulteress. He makes a similar point in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In verse 39, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she's free to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. There's the answer to the question from the Scriptures. Jesus and then Paul in Romans 7, 3, and also 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39. As long as the two individuals are alive and they entered into the covenant of marriage, they are to remain married, and they should stay together the rest of their life. Especially if they're Christians. Christians, they have two options. They get into a spat. Either separate for a while or be reconciled. Divorce should never be an option, but that's another question for another time. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. Always like to hear what you have to say. Also, search Facebook for the Life from the Pulpit page on Facebook, and like us there on Facebook. Also, follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. And now on iTunes. Search the iTunes store for the Life from the Pulpit podcast and get all of our episodes that way on your particular iDevice. Be sure and stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, www.lifefromthepulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1 John, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Also, check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org, mercedchurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there to help you in your Bible study as well. And, as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.